Welcome to Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Next week, you should know we're moving to a new time. You're going to hear your Week in Review on Fridays at noon instead of 10 o'clock. Okay? Got it? Starting next Friday, Week in Review at noon. And that's not the only change that I'm here to tell you about. Our top story this week for a lot of our listeners is that KUOW is buying KPLU. Yes, KPLU is, of course, the Puget Sound area's other major local public radio station, 88.5 FM. They offer a mix of jazz and news. If this deal goes through as expected, KUOW will take over KPLU and manage both stations. And here to tell you about it is KUOW's general manager, Karen Mathis. Welcome,
hey,
Karen.
Good morning. Good to be here.
What does this mean for listeners turning on their radios?
Well, you know, anytime an opportunity is offered to KUOW, after I ask, does it fit our strategic objectives, I ask, is there a community win? And I think there's definitely a community win here because it's going to be more of everything that people have demonstrated that they wanted. There'll be more news. There'll be more jazz. Minor inconvenience now that you have to, you know, turn the dial or press a different button on your smartphone to get, you know, to one service or the other. But I think for the volume of new content that people will get, that's a pretty minor inconvenience, I hope.
I will ask you about more news and more jazz in a moment. First of all, why? Why is this happening?
Well, all I can talk to you about is the why from our side, you know. Pacific Lutheran University had their own reasons, but when the opportunity...
Pacific Lutheran holds the license of KPLU. They're basically selling the station to KUOW.
Absolutely. They're selling the station to University of Washington.
Right.
And then we...
Which holds our license.
As UW's agent, we will be operating the service. So from our side, the why was it totally fit our strategic objectives. We talk about growing our service, being more nimble and robust in the digital space, making sure that we are connected to the burgeoning, you know, ethnic and cultural communities here, that we're more inclusive, that we've got to position ourselves to be ready for audience next. The baby boomers can't last forever. And right now, baby boomers are our core and they're paying most of the freight to pay for public radio. But, you know, there's a pivot there. There's an audience pivot. There's a demographic pivot.
You mean people dying?
People actually do die.
Uh-huh.
Yes, unfortunately. So we've just got to be positioned and ready that we'll be relevant and resonant to the next audience that's coming down the pike and that is already sampling us through our digital presentations and story sharing on Facebook and that sort of thing. So I think this furthers those goals.
But how does that happen? How does this sale, this pivot, reach a new audience, a younger audience? How does it serve those people?
Well, what we're buying, KPLU 88.5 is a family of frequencies. The package is 4 full-power FMs and 7 translators, which are little short-space stations that fill in the gap of a station's signal coverage. So we're buying 11 frequencies. KUOW already has 94.9 and then our extended frequencies in Bellingham, and Olympia Tumwater. So we're going to look at the map. In fact, I have a map here that's not ready for distribution yet, but we're kind of looking at, okay, we got 15 frequencies in play. We can reapportion what is on each of those frequencies, extend the reach of the news, still have critical mass of coverage for the new music station. Our goal is to make sure that anyone who could get jazz or news before will be able to get jazz or news after. May not be on the same station, but we want to preserve that coverage so that there's reach. Obviously, our news team is we're Puget Sound Public Radio. We've tried to cover the whole region. We have partnerships that allows us to cover the three-state area through N3, but we need to redeploy our resources to make sure that we are doing justice and coverage to the whole area. A question I'm being asked urgently is, well, what about the news team at PLU? And, you know, we're still building what that looks like. What does optimal coverage in the region looks like? How many people will that take? We don't know yet. There's a possibility. We already have news and information positions that are posted right now, some more that were due to come open in November, December, and the KPL people are certainly welcome to apply to those. But we don't know how much bigger our newsroom and content making should be. We're already pretty big comparatively in the system. We could need, you know, more people, but I'm committed and I've committed to Pacific Lutheran that we will do nothing to destabilize KPLU. So no approach, no poach, but if they want to apply to positions that we put up, they are certainly welcome.
Well, you said that there at the beginning that there would be more news, and this, as you said, is a frequent question. On our Facebook page, KOW Public Radio, Mark speaks for a lot of people when he says more media consolidation is never a good thing. So explain how consolidation would, which would mean more news, if we don't even know that there are going to be more reporters and news staff coming over to this new all-news station?
Well, both stations were already in expansion mode for news and information coverage anyway, because that's what we obviously felt the region needed. KPLU started up, you know, Sound Effect, their magazine, and they were expanding. They've hired, made some significant hires in recent months of new people. We're expanding. I think our newest beat is Joshua McNichol's Growing Pains beat. And, you know, so we're expanding in our coverage perspective anyway, and I don't think there's any reason to assume that that would suddenly contract. We're going to continue to expand, and particularly if, you know, some of the people want to come over here, we end up hiring them, we can make the budget work. You know, that's my job, to make the numbers work. If we can make the numbers work and expand to optimally cover the region, then that'll be good. There may be more beats, more voices. But I think both stations were in expansion mode. And I think as a combined entity, there's no reason to think that that wouldn't continue.
I, of course, have more questions for you, but let's welcome our panel, as we do, for the Week in Review. Luke Burbank hosts a public radio show on this station, Live Wire. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Bill.
Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com, where she journalizes. Bill Finkbeiner is the former Republican state senator, state majority leader here. And let's start with a fellow public radio employee. Luke, questions for, this is KUOW's general manager, Karen Mathis, talking about KUOW, University of Washington, acquiring KPLU and running both stations. News here and jazz there.
I guess I'm curious about how this came together, because I think from the outside, it looks like the stronger station absorbing the station that wasn't maybe getting as many listeners. And the jazz format is certainly something that some people really enjoy, but may not appeal to as broad an audience as, you know, the stuff KUOW has been doing. I speak, of course, of Livewire, Saturdays at 5. So who approached whom? Was this KPLU reaching out to KUOW and saying, would you be interested? Because I think if people find that out, it might change their opinion of how this whole thing went down.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny. One of the first calls I made yesterday was to my predecessor, Wayne Roth, who was the general manager of KUOW for 30 years. And when I told Wayne, you know, that we had gotten a deal, he said, oh, my God, that only took 28 years. So, I mean, this has been...
I can attest. I was here then, and this has been a long conversation.
Yeah, so it's been a very, very long conversation, and it kind of... it ping-ponged back and forth. I think 28 years ago, that was probably 2 years then into Wayne's tenure, you know, the first overture about, and I don't remember now if that was a proposal of a full merger or just consolidation of back-end infrastructure. I wasn't here then, but I think 28 years ago, it did start on the KUOW side, but then over those three decades, it's ping-ponged back and forth. Every single administration of both stations, this has come up. When KUOW was without a GM, it came up, and it was initiated on the KPLU side. And then as soon as I got here and Joey was in the GM seat, we started talking, you know, well, what could we do together? Because we're always thinking efficiencies. Listener donations are so precious and so I don't want to say rare, because we have thousands of people giving, but you know, nowhere near even 25% of our audience gives to support. So every time we get a donation, we're trying to be the best stewards possible of that money. And so Joey and I had had conversations about, well, could we have a single, you know, donor database, and this single piece of hardware software would, you know, you could push out your fundraising pieces, and well, maybe, but you know, we've got other people involved here. It's not just the station managers. You've got an independent 501c3 board for us in the Puget Sound Public Radio board. You got UW's board. You got PLU's board. And it took, you know, getting all of those entities of one accord saying, yeah, we think that acquisition is the way to go, and we think now is the time. So it's really hard to pinpoint the genesis, because it's been a 30-year almost conversation.
And by the way, I reached out to, you know, I should say I got my start at KPLU. KPLU is an excellent, as you know, news service. Their newsroom is fantastic. I've known Joey Cohn for years and many more, and I asked him to come on the show and talk about this as well. And he said, well, I really got to be with my team right now. There's plenty, and there'll be lots more time to talk about. So I'd like to talk to PLU and to KPLU, and hopefully we will. I want to bring in, as I mentioned, Bill Finkbeiner's here. And Bill, you had a good question for me about you. It's such a good Republican question. You said, what's the profit model of public radio anyway?
Yeah. Well, and so I'm new to this stuff, and I can see how it makes sense to consolidate, especially if you kind of have different formats. What I don't understand, I guess my question would be, is how do you sort of recoup that cost? So if that $8 million goes to PLU, that's sort of an investment in the station. I guess, does it come from listeners, or what's sort of the business model of the decision?
Yeah, the bulk of our money comes from individual giving, you know, individual private philanthropy. And when I use that P word, you know, that's from big, big gifts to the average $130 giver or the $5 a month person. So listener money is where that comes from. We get a significant amount of money, but it's still less than 40% of the revenue pie from our business and corporate sponsors. The money that we raise in our community leverages about 4 to 6 cents on the dollar from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So that federal grant is an earned leveraged grant where they're just putting a few pennies for every dollar that listeners put in. So we're banking, I guess, on the fact that this melding of titans, because KUOW is an overachiever. KPLU, for a mixed format station, is an overachiever. When you look at all the stations in the public radio system that have a dual format of something, either jazz and news or classical and news, you know, on average, they have about a 1.3 share of their market. KPLU is double that, and KUOW is, you know, is a high performer as well. So you've really got a melding of titans here. And I think that, you know, the stellar service that we're going to be able to provide, that, you know, you'll be able to hear the news service from Tacoma into Victoria, BC. You're going to have a huge coverage area for the jazz programming. We intend to really lean into the community engagement, music education in the schools, supporting the jazz venues, supporting jazz events like Earshot Jazz Festival. When people see the heightened service, we're banking that they will want to contribute to support that, and more money will come.
We're talking with KUOW's general manager, Karen Mathis, about KUOW and the University of Washington purchasing and then managing KPLU 88.5 FM as two separate streams, news and jazz. Erica C. Barnett, I reintroduced. Do you have a question for Karen Mathis about this?
Sure.
And we'll move on to other big news stories of the week.
Yeah, first I want to say I'm encouraged if this means that some of the daytime programming is going to shift and perhaps be more Puget Sound-based and more local. I can't tell you how frustrated I get at times when I'm listening to the BBC in the middle of the day and it's, you know, a story about the Duchess of this or some soccer match that I don't know about. happening somewhere else, and perhaps that's
I believe you mean football. Go on.
I believe you mean sport.
Sport. Pardon me. Pardon me. I'm so sorry. My concern is pretty much the same as the one expressed by the Facebook viewer or listener who said, you know, how is media consolidation ever a good thing? I agree. You know, KPLU does have a really great and scrappy news department. And I totally agree with the fact that 65 hours of overlapping NPR content is a lot. But I wonder, you know, how is the news world not shrinking from this overall when you have a limited number of hours for news and you're getting rid of some of them and not bringing all of them back?
Yeah. Well, I have to touch on one thing you said, and this is one of the pain points that public radio is dealing with, the definition of local. What is local? Is local a one-hour show? Is local, you know, over the course of a week, 60 story components that move through the river of content of the day? You know, and our conventional listeners define that in one way, our new listeners define that in another way. So I would contend that we are just as local, just as scrappy as KPLU. We strive for this kind of seamless river of content, model so that more people get to hear the content. We're getting the most bang for the buck. I don't want to get too wonky here, Bill, as I want to do, but you know, when you look at how our weekly audience is spread out, we have graphs of this where our highest listening period of the week is 7:30 a.m. on a weekday. Biggest by far, that's the biggest listening period. 7% of our total weekly audience is listening at 7:30 in the morning. And so 93% are not. And so we don't feel that it's good deployment of listener gifts if we do these one-offs and, you know, the whole appointment radio thing of, oh, here it is for an hour and then it goes away. That's not going to work, even with our conventional audience. That's definitely not going to work with younger audience that expects on demand and fit to my schedule and what meet you here at this time for this content. No way. So, you know, we've got to make that pivot, and it's painful because, like I said, the baby boomer conventional listeners are paying the freight and they have an expectation, and the newer people coming in the door have a completely different expectation of media. So that being said, how does consolidation make things better when you're consolidating these two superpowers, you know, under one roof, and we can get the economies of scale? I mean, just because the main studio will originate from here, that doesn't mean we're not going to have far-flung reporters. Reporters don't need to come into a building anymore with the electronic equipment. You can feed from anywhere. You can feed from India. So, you know, I don't want people to think that just because we say, oh, you know, we have this studio already ready to go here on the Ave, and that the main origination will be here. The reporters can be everywhere and anywhere, and it can be a very rich and robust pool of more voices, more stories, more citizen-generated content. Both stations have been about that. You know, we've been out in the community more, trying to do more community engagement events, experiments like Local Wonder, where we're actually letting the citizens kind of drive the coverage. What are you interested in? What should we report on? Here's the top three. Vote, you know, and so engaging citizens is something that both stations embrace. And I think when you get those synergies together, and then you get the economies of reusing those precious, you know, average $135 a person gifts to really get them deployed to maximum effect, it's going to be better. It's going to be more.
Is it still going to be called KPLU?
No. Because that's a branding thing for PLU, Pacific Lutheran University. So we haven't picked a new call sign yet. We'll be getting
Can we do a Name the Jazz Station contest now?
Well, you know, I was just thinking it would be great to have the audience involved in that some way. You know, we could pick any letters we wanted, but whether or not they're available in the system, that's another issue. But that could be kind of fun.
KUOW's General Manager Karen Mathis filling you in on this news that KUOW and University of Washington are buying KPLU from Pacific Lutheran University. So there are going to be a news service and a jazz service. There'll be two separate things, and there's a lot still, it sounds like, we don't know about who's going where, and we'll keep talking about that. We'll hear from a lot more people and you. And by the way, this deal is subject to the approval of the FCC.
Correct.
I haven't heard anything besides that we expect that'll happen, but we'll keep following.
Yeah, it'll be sometime in 2016. They take their time.
Okay. Karen Mathis, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
On KUOW's Week in Review. Yes, there's more news beyond your favorite radio station, and that's what we do on the Week in Review. So coming up, we'll talk war on Christmas, war on orcas, war on gum, war on taxes, and war on people not making at least $70,000 a year. Coming up, stay tuned. Luke Burbank, Erica C. Barnett, Bill Finkbeiner, and Bill Radke, and you are figuring out what happened this week. Go ahead and sip that, Luke. Is Starbucks fighting a war on Christmas? It's that time of year when the Starbucks cups turn red for the holidays. What holidays? We don't know. The cups don't say. They don't say Merry Christmas. They don't have snowflakes even. Some Christians are accusing Starbucks of taking Christmas out of the holidays. Protesters include the famously devout Donald Trump.
Today I read, and I have Starbucks. They're my tenants. Did you read about Starbucks? No more Merry Christmas on Starbucks. No more. I wouldn't buy. Hey, look, I'm speaking against myself. I have one of the most successful Starbucks in Trump Tower. Maybe we should boycott Starbucks. I don't know. Seriously. I don't care. By the way, that's the end of that lease, but who cares? Who cares? Who cares? But today, a big story that Starbucks is taking Merry Christmas off. No more Merry Christmas. I will tell you, lots of big things, lots of little things. You can call this anything you want. But if I become president, we're all going to be saying Merry Christmas again. That I can tell you. That wow. I can tell you.
Wow. How should we feel about the new red Starbucks cups? Round the horn. Luke can't even speak, so let's...
The Venn diagram overlap of things that are not real that we just heard is a perfect circle.
You want to list them?
Donald Trump's hair and the war on Christmas are both things that are not real.
Okay. And the Merry Christmas cups that never existed.
Isn't that the case, right?
It's absolutely the case.
This is a protest of a thing that did not exist in the first place, these supposed Jesus-loving cups that were everywhere.
Right. Okay, anything to add?
It just feels to me like, you know, if Donald Trump says something, then it's just got to be in every single story. And the other thing that I found funny about this is that basically he's arguing that Christmas isn't commercial enough.
Yeah, that was the weird part for me. Like, wait a minute, which is the war on Christmas?
Exactly. Yeah. We need more corporate involvement in Christmas, apparently, if you know, from Trump's views.
Well, so what the guy whose video kind of originated this whole thing said was that everybody should just prank the Starbucks baristas by saying their name is Merry Christmas,
right?
Which I would love to see. Can you imagine? I mean, everybody saying Merry Christmas is their name. I would love to see them all mix up their orders like that. That would just be extremely
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. No.
No, other Merry Christmas. No, no, you.
Just on the subject of Starbucks cup naming or writing your name on that, I ran into Howard Schultz in Madison Park a while ago, and he and I presume his wife were both drinking Starbucks from the Madison Park Starbucks, and they had written Howard on his cup. I thought, don't they know his name at this point?
Right.
They probably know who this coffee is going to.
As far as I'm concerned, whatever they write on my cup is usually the Merry Christmas, because I never know what it says.
Yeah, the handwriting.
Okay, what is the Dunkin' Donuts has come in, and that's a Starbucks competitor, and their cup says Joy. What is the perfect thing to have on your cup at Christmas time, including no red color, you know, no color at all, nothing?
Relax.
Our Lord and Savior. Like, what do you want to see from a corporation at Christmas time?
Relax. It'll be over soon. Or maybe, you know, just a plain white cup. Just no logo.
No acknowledgement.
No acknowledgement. No logo.
You don't enjoy the seasonal, like, hey, this is when I get my pumpkin spice latte. This is the taste of autumn. This is the red cup that gets me in the spirit. You don't want any of that.
You know, I will confess, I do. I get into the holiday spirit. Yeah. However, you know, if we want to be just absolutely neutral, I think just a blank cup is the way to go.
I don't have a problem with putting Merry Christmas on the cups either, by the way. I don't think the war on Christmas is a real thing. But I also don't think putting Merry Christmas on a cup necessarily disrespects other traditions or other holidays that people might enjoy. And I think Starbucks as a business will probably do the research. I mean, if they were to do this. I have major hesitation about even talking about this like it's a real thing.
Yeah.
Like dragging Starbucks into a non-extant issue.
We'll move on.
But I mean, to the degree that places, schools, other things are not saying Merry Christmas or whatever, I feel like saying Merry Christmas does not disrespect Kwanzaa, does not disrespect Hanukkah in my
mind.
But
the sheer weight.
I don't see it as zero sum.
The weight of it. I realize it's not a public arena. It's not a football stadium where the coach is praying. But just the sheer volume of Starbucksiness, you don't feel like that would feel oppressive to somebody who's not Christian when they're being told Merry Christmas by the big mermaid?
Well, coming from a family that is half Jewish myself, I think my mom feels very oppressed and annoyed by it. But on the other hand, my Jewish grandparents put up a Christmas tree every year, so
right.
Maybe they had Stockholm syndrome.
Right. Okay. Other news of the week. Is there other news of the week? Oh, I'm looking at a correction that I'll read dutifully, because just like Ron Burgundy, I will put whatever is on the teleprompter. I will read. Just a few minutes ago, you heard KUOW GM Karen Mathis say there were news jobs currently open at KUOW. That's not correct. KUOW does plan to open jobs in the future, and KPLU journalists will be welcome to apply through the UW open hire process.
Was that the line that was forming outside the station?
Yes.
Based on that erroneous comment?
Apparently. Okay, so now you know, on the Week in Review, Luke Burbank, Erica C. Barnett, Bill Finkbeiner, I'm Bill Radke. The SeaWorld of San Diego is going to stop riding Shamu around the pool. SeaWorld says it will put its orcas in a more natural setting there and stop having trainers jump off orcas' backs and make them do tricks for food. Amen, says Michael Harris of the Pacific Whale Watch Association.
You learn nothing about these whales except that you can dominate them. In a way, it was like the modern-day lion tamer with a chair and a lion, and it didn't teach anything about the whales. It taught domination.
Some of SeaWorld's orcas, by the way, are related to ones that swim up here in the Puget Sound area. Meanwhile, a member of Congress from Southern California is going farther, proposing legislation to stop any kind of display of orcas for entertainment altogether. No more capturing wild orcas, no more breeding captive orcas, no more orca shows. We have Rob Vernon with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. So, Rob, I assume you disagree with this move from Congress to stop orca shows.
We do disagree with that notion. We think that it will definitely lead to a slippery slope here in the future of Congress deciding what animals zoological facilities can display publicly.
When you see a trainer riding an orca, how do you react in your gut?
Well, I would like to correct you on that, Bill. The trainers at SeaWorld and other facilities haven't been going in the water with killer whales for quite some time, so they're definitely not doing that right now.
Mm-hmm. How about orca shows? They do tricks and jump through hoops. How does that feel to you?
Well, a lot of the shows, I think, are actually really interesting. You're seeing a lot of behaviors that the animals mimic in the wild, and it's a way that the animals are able to be exercised. And not only that, for AZA-accredited facilities, any shows that are going on, whether they're at an aquarium or at a zoo, it is a requirement of accreditation to deliver a conservation education message. And all of the facilities do that on a regular basis. And in particular at SeaWorld, they have a they deliver that message actually throughout the show that you see there at Shamu Stadium.
I do want to ask you about education, but I have to follow up. How is an orca jumping up onto its back fin and backing up, et cetera, for food? How is that, you said, mimicking what it does in the wild? How so?
Well, they do mimic behaviors that they see that do occur in the wild. They're using muscles and working like they do in the wild.
So what about education? We've had orcas in captivity for decades now, and we could expand this to elephants. We've had a big fight here in Seattle, as you probably know, with Woodland Park Zoo. And the question is, we've had these big animals in captivity for a long time. How much is there really left to learn from them versus just profiting from the fact that we like them, to watch them?
That's a great question, and we've done quite a bit of study on this, and what we found is that not only do people not necessarily have the resources to go see these animals in the wild, zoos and aquariums are really the first line of where people are able to see these animals firsthand. Oftentimes when they do visit, there are docents and volunteers that are delivering messages and delivering information on not only what the animals are doing there at the zoo, but then also or at the aquarium, and also what they're doing in the wild, and how what they're seeing is mirrors what's going on in the wild.
I want to get a reaction from my panelists, but real quick, what would happen to these captive orcas if they were released?
That's a good question. I don't know that we know the answer to that. There was a book that was published recently called Killing Kiko by Mark Simmons, who led the effort to try to rehabilitate an animal and basically rewild the animal, which ended not well for the animal. It did end up dying in the wild. So I think the answer to that question is we don't know.
Okay. Any reaction, Erica C.?
Well, as you know, as someone who went to SeaWorld as a kid, I loved watching I think they were dolphin shows at the time. And I have to say, I don't remember any volunteers and docents teaching me anything. What I learned was that these animals are trick ponies, they want to be there, that they're happy.
You come to care about them through the
no,
through those
I
shows?
I didn't care about them through what I learned about how inhumane those shows are. And so I guess having people providing information on the sidelines doesn't have the impact on, particularly on children who are, you know, the main audience at shows like this, you know, in my experience, it doesn't have the same impact as seeing these cute animals jumping through hoops.
Reaction to that, Rob Vernon, Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
Well, I think for the 183 million visitors to AZA-accredited aquariums and zoos around the world, 50 million of those visitors are children. And we also, on an annual basis, deliver nearly 3,000 different education programs that are occurring there at the local level. So I would say that, you know, what takes place at a show is just one small component of the massive education outreach that AZA-accredited zoos and aquariums do on a regular basis.
Talking about SeaWorld of San Diego stopping its displays for a more natural orca setting, and a member of Congress talking about stopping a display of orcas altogether. Luke Burbank, reaction?
Well, I want to start by mentioning I'm a massive hypocrite on the issue of animal welfare, in that I eat meat, which is not great for the animals typically when that's happening to them.
Right. Could
but,
be better.
Yeah, they've had better days. But this idea that we have this sort of charismatic megafauna that we entrap and that we go look at and point at, it feels, with all due respect to the guest, and also the people who work at zoos and aquariums, because I sense those people love animals. I really think that the folks at Woodland Park Zoo here in Seattle and SeaWorld, I don't think that they have any malice towards the animals, but it feels like something that in 50 or 100 years we're going to say, can you believe we used to do that? I feel like that there's a sort of collective awareness of that that's happening right now, and I'm sort of part of it, I think.
Rob, do you ever wonder, I assume that you care about animals, but do you ever wonder whether, sometimes history makes us look really bad on a question like this?
Bill, I think that is true. If you look at zoos and aquariums 10 years ago, they're vastly different than they are today. Today, when you visit an AZA-accredited zoo in particular, you see large open spaces. You don't see bars. You don't see concrete floors. And that's really through the progressive accreditation process that we've built over the last 20 years. to really elevate the standards of the best of the best zoological facilities in the United States. And so I would agree. Zoos 10 years ago are definitely not the same as they are today, and in fact, they're much more improved.
Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm going to stick up for Rob a little bit. You know, I grew up in this area. I have always wanted to see a wild orca. Every time I'm on the ferries or anywhere near the sound, I'm looking for them. I'm thinking one day I'm going to see one out there. Never saw one. The only time I've ever seen one was in SeaWorld. And, you know, and then same thing with an orangutan or elephants. I'm never going to see those things. And it's different seeing it in real life. I think we probably, it feels sometimes like, you know, the way the world is going, that probably in 50 years, you know, maybe there aren't going to be any more zoos. But I think it's a little bit hypocritical too if we look at, like, well, these animals should be doing what they're doing in the wild. Well, most of us that have dogs and cats or, you know, other pets, they're not doing what they're doing in the wild. Our dog, I don't think, is probably, I don't think he'd last, you know, 4 hours out there if we just dropped him off in the woods someplace, you know, and when they're talking about trying to sort of rewild Keiko or whatever the other orca was, that, you know, I was just imagining it trying to do that with our dog to try to, you know, rewild him. But, you know, so there's an advantage to being around real animals and especially in sort of an urban environment. I think that's got some benefits.
Last word, Rob Vernon, before we let you go.
I would like to say that, you know, I think visiting an accredited aquarium and zoo is a great experience, and I hope zoos are around in 50 years. And actually, that's the last point. One thing to consider is that there's very little actual real wild left, and most experts agree that what we're learning in zoologic and wild, both of them contribute greatly to wildlife management overall. So what we learn from being able to see and study these animals up close helps us take care of them and manage their populations in the wild so that they don't go extinct.
Rob Vernon with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Thank you, Rob.
You're welcome.
He's opposing this move from a member of Congress that we just stop the display of orcas. And as we said, we could expand this out to elephants, and then who knows next? It does seem to go down the food chain, down the size chain.
I think, you know, there's a couple of false alternatives being played out here, though. Either we have to release orcas that have been, you know, bred in captivity into the wild and watch them die, or we have to keep breeding them, you know, indefinitely in captivity. We could also just let the ones who are in captivity die naturally and stop this, you know, what I see as a fairly barbaric practice. And I also think that, you know, the idea that we will either let the animals, you know, somehow die out, or we will go to zoos and aquariums and see them is a false choice, because animals like this don't have value by virtue of being seen by humans.
When my wife and I were living in Port Townsend, we were renting a place that was right on the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And for the whole time we were there, my dream was to see orcas in the wild. And I saw them one day and I freaked the hell out, to be honest with you, because it was so cool. But I got really into reading about them, and like, their life is no picnic out there in the wild. Mm. Same thing for elephants, same thing for all of these animals. But the difference is, we're not, other than maybe environmental degradation, we're not imposing that on them. Like for the J-pod, it ain't sunshine and roses all the time out there in the Salish Sea.
Right.
But that's their world. When we take them and we put them in captivity, then we're bringing them into our world. And then what happens to them there is, in my mind, our fault, you know?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. What if that orangutan loves that heater where they blast the lovely, lovely warmth out at Woodland Park Zoo, et cetera? We've got other stuff to talk about on KUOW's Week in Review. We're right back at it in just a moment.
Traffic reporter.
Perhaps the orangutan was not the best example of an animal that would be grateful to have warmth in Woodland Park Zoo. Luke Burbank, Bill Finkbeiner, Erica C. Barnett, and I'm Bill Radke, learning from the top stories of the week. Remember the local CEO who made his company's minimum wage $70,000 a year, the credit card processing company Gravity Payments? The CEO, Dan Price, cut his own $1 million salary to pay all of his 120 employees $70,000 or more. He's gotten lots of national attention over this, including an appearance this week on Comedy Central's The Daily Show, now with Trevor Noah, who asked him about whether capitalists should just go make money.
Our system is set up to incentivize me as a CEO to try to suck out as much value, pay everybody the least amount possible, charge everyone the most possible, and take the most for myself. And does that system actually lead to the happiest life? And I would suggest that some of the most successful companies out there actually had something that was really magical called love. And love is a rational force that can overwhelm some of these economics and create like this new economic reality that we're going to.
This is insane. So basically...
Only insane?
If I'm understanding, this is what I'm being presented with right now. So you are a young man who believes in sharing with others, and you have long hair and a beard, and and you preach love. Have we met before?
Love is a rational force that can overwhelm economics, says the love child of Jesus and Brad Pitt, the CEO Dan Price, if you've seen him, of Gravity Payments. Love is a rational force that can overwhelm economics. Is that true, Republican Bill Finkbeiner?
Oh, I got kind of a different take on this. What I think is really kind of cool, I think there's been for a while sort of this East Coast, West Coast thing going on where we're sort of trying to, you know, stand up to New York and show that there's something happening out here. And I think this guy's Seattle's Donald Trump. I think when you look at Donald Trump, wow, he really epitomizes a lot of the good and bad in New York, this sort of brash and egotistical and over the top and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And this
is egotistical?
Just a bit, I think. Yeah. Maybe. But I think this Dan Price sort of like epitomizes sort of Seattle's capitalist, you know, spirit as it exists. Clearly, it's a real business, and he's doing well. And I think one of the things people don't point out is that most of his wealth isn't coming from his salary. Most of his wealth is coming from the asset, which is the business. And the value of the business is based on its income. And so if he goes and sells that, that's where he's going to sort of, you know, make his big bucks further down the line. So anyway, I think it's very admirable what he's done. And it kind of puts a Seattle spin on, you know, business that I think stands up well to.
Is love a rational force that can overwhelm economics?
I don't think love is a rational force, but I think it can overwhelm economics. I think people make uneconomical choices all the time for love, right? Like, look at Valentine's Day.
Or Christmas.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, I disagree. Surprise, surprise. You know, I mean, I agree that love isn't...
The C isn't for agreeable.
The C is for consistent. And I do not believe in noblesse oblige as an economic force or an economic ruler. I don't think we should depend on the benevolence of our, you know, our corporate dictators or our government dictators to be kind to us and make us, you know, make us sort of fat and happy, because A, every company's not going to do that. It's a small company. And B, the whole reason we have unions now is because those benevolent dictators weren't so benevolent. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, having this guy get, you know, a ton of attention for doing something that was very nice, giving his employees higher salaries, sends the message that we should just have nicer rulers, and we don't need, you know, workers' movements. We don't need to have agitation from below. We don't need a higher floor. We don't need a higher minimum wage, maybe. Now, I don't know if this particular CEO believes that or doesn't, but that's the message that it sends, that, you know, if the rulers would just be nicer, the people being ruled wouldn't have to agitate, and they do have to agitate.
I mean, I guess I don't see it as one or the other, or I guess I didn't read this story about Gravity and the minimum wage as a way of saying the workers' rights movement is unnecessary. I just saw it as a guy who wanted to try to share his wealth. I mean, that was my takeaway from it, but that might just be me. I'll give an example that I've seen, and I don't know how I'm going to get home from the radio station, but I think Uber is making a real mistake in this department. I used to do ads for Uber, by the way, and I sound like Donald Trump now. I'm friends with the people that do Uber in Seattle.
they're great.
And Howard Schultz, apparently.
One of the most successful Uber companies is in my building. When I used to take Uber when it started out, and the drivers were exceedingly happy to be working with Uber. I would always talk to them and hear that. And Uber has had a record in terms of its valuation. It's a tremendously valuable company. And every driver I talk to talks about how unhappy they are with the way that Uber grinds them down on, like, when the car is sitting still, there's this complicated sort of mathematical formula about what they're making, and it's very low, according to some of the drivers I've talked to. This is a case where I think Uber is really going to hurt itself in the long run, because a little love goes a long way. And rationally and from a business standpoint, they can, because they have the market dominated, they can do this. But I think it's going to hurt them in the long run. And it's uncapitalistic and un-American to a degree to say this, but I think companies do better when they don't treat the people that work for them like crap.
But you can't rely on that. I mean, you can feel that way, and that may be true, but you can't rely on companies to always act rationally if you're right. And your example of, you know, a company, you know, doing the right thing by its employees just sounds a lot to me like charity. And we don't rely entirely on charity in this country either, because it's not as consistent as government. We have a safety net. And so, yeah, it's a slippery slope from this one company to no social safety net. I realize that. But I do think this kind of attitude heads us in that direction.
We've been talking about the bigger meaning of the of Seattle's Donald Trump. I'm going to remember that. Gravity payments, making its own minimum wage $70,000 a year. As a coda here, or as a last point, it's debatable whether this has been a rationally good business practice for the company. Price's brother has sued him for violating his brother's rights as a minority shareholder. Two of Gravity Payments' employees, at least, have quit, telling the New York Times they thought it was unfair to double the pay of some employees while the long-standing staff didn't get rewarded. So now you're dealing with kind of behavioral economics of other people getting more and faster than I'm getting it. And on the other hand, the company says it's gained a lot of customers because, you know, look at all the publicity, and a lot of people think this is a great decision and are working with Gravity Payments. And finally, one of their customers, Canlis, Seattle's own Canlis restaurant, said that Brian Canlis said that Price's decision makes it harder for the rest of us. So, which maybe you want it to be. On KOW's Week in Review, let's try to work in another story or two from the news of the week. The Pike Place Market gum wall getting deep cleaned, been steam cleaning it, supposedly to protect the integrity of the bricks and not just because it's gross. The owner of Ghost Alley Espresso next door says the gum will stick again.
It's like an organism. It grows back, or like a lost limb. It returns. And I think that's actually the most exciting part, is having people continue to interact with it. Even if it goes away briefly, it still comes back.
The Strangers, Charles Mudede, called the gum wall the wall of white privilege, because if brown people stuck their gum on the wall, it would just be unruly and unclean. But white people think it's adorable, so it gets to stay. What does the gum wall's existence and popularity say about us, Erica C. Barnett?
Well, I don't think it says quite as much as Charles thinks it says, but I do like his point that if this was something that black people or Arab American people started doing, it would be shut down real quick. But, you know, I think it's our kitschy tourist attraction. I think every city has one. And frankly, I think we're really blowing out of proportion that this is somehow about Seattle's character or, you know, that it says something deep and meaningful about us. I mean, it's a kitschy tourist attraction, just the same way that the fish throwers at Pike Place Market are.
Pinky B?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's, you know, sometimes we can put some deep meaning into weird things. It's a kitschy tourist attraction, but it's not one you're going to find anywhere else. And it's not like we did it, you know, it's not like the Chamber of Commerce went out and said, hey, let's get more tourists here if we all stick our gum on the wall. So
I learned some things on KUOW actually last week when this was coming up. One of them was that originally there were pennies stuck in the gum.
Oh.
And then this was from the woman who runs the espresso stand, I believe. And then the pennies went away, and I thought, that is somebody who really wants a penny. Somebody scoured the gum wall for the pennies. And then the other thing I learned during that conversation was that people have been seen taking the gum off the wall late at night and chewing it.
Yes.
And that haunts my nightscape.
Yes, you cannot
forever.
Unlearn that.
Yes.
The losers of the bar bets. That's Luke Burbank, who hosts Public Radio's Live Wire, Saturday, 5 o'clock. What's coming up tomorrow night?
Great question. We've got Jesse Eisenberg on the show of acting and now writing fame, and Diana Nyad, and somebody passed out in the theater while we were doing the show, but we edited that out because it would be really weird to just hear on the radio. It was an exciting taping.
Is that person okay?
They're doing well.
Okay, good. Erica C. Barnett, I know you're following. We don't really have time to get into it. But we're going to know. We still don't know all the city council races that we opined about so much last week.
Yeah, Shannon Braddock in District 1 City Council has tripled her lead on Lisa Herbold to 18 votes.
Yes.
And we'll get another drop of votes today.
And then a challenge of some kind, right?
And then likely a challenge. If it's within 0.5%, there'll be an automatic recount, and there could be a challenge as well.
Erica C. Barnett with the C is for crank.com. Bill Finkbeiner, any last words? Former Republican State Senate Majority Leader.
Baby boomers apparently aren't going to last forever, we heard.
Yes, we heard that at the top of the show. Again, I should say, you know, if you're a fan of Week in Review, and of course you are, tune in for us doing this coming Friday, not at 10 o'clock, but at noon. See you at 12.
Does this mean you're going to have a semi-normal sleep schedule?
Yeah, by the way.
Mazel tov.
Yeah, I'm only going to sleep once a day. Our social media producer today has been Isolde Raftery, live tweeting the show, and we're at KUOW Public Radio. Jason Pagano produces it. Bernard Ouellet engineers it. Thank you for tuning into it, and we'll see you next week at noon on the Week in Review.